Good evening, saints. Okay, so we have been discussing the hydroplate theory in as it relates to Noah's flood. As I've stated a couple of times, I believe this to be probably the best overall explanation of the geographic features that we find that are on the earth. This is all based in not just somebody's wild idea, but Dr. Walt Brown, who put this together. I think he has two PhDs, mechanical engineering and what was the other one? Is it geoscience or something along those lines? Geology, maybe. At any rate, this is all from his book. It's called In the Beginning, an excellent book. If you can get a hold of them, they're about $60 right about now. That would be for the 8th edition that's out now. They are working on a 9th, but I think it'll be a little while before that one comes out. So we've been talking about the flood. I just want to review real quickly. There's four phases to the flood. We've already covered the rupture, which of course was a result of a tidal pumping and the pressure that was created underneath the earth's crust in what was called the Mohorovicic layer, essentially a layer of water. Under the crust. And during that rupture, of course, that water that was ejected was ejected at a very high speed, and it would have entered into the atmosphere. That eruption would have caused about a 10-mile deep slit in the crust of the earth, and then, of course, from there we have the flood beginning. So I'm going to skip through a couple of these because we have covered them before. Just a quick illustration of what that may have looked like when the fountains of the great deep opened. Here's another example, more of an illustration perspective to show you that when the water was ejected, it wouldn't have just gone straight up and come straight back down. It would have been deflected on the atmosphere and then also left the inner atmosphere and gone into the outer atmosphere. The extreme rain that would have come down as a result of this water being released is something that the world had never seen and will never see again. The rupture, as I mentioned, was about 10 miles high. As the water was coming out, it would have been pulverizing those sides of those cliffs, and then eventually during this initial rupture phase, the extreme rain would have dropped for many days, and the Bible tells you how long that was. And then, of course, during that particular time, while the hydroplate theories are being, while the hydroplates are being created, we would have had a rupture that went around the entire globe. I've shown you this before, and you will see it a few more times. But this just illustrates the locations of the ocean trenches on the globe. And if you notice that the ocean trenches, at least in the specifically in the Atlantic, especially in the Atlantic, you can see how the Mid-Atlantic Ridge mirrors very much the shape of the continents, of the shores. And that is a result of probably where the rupture began, was somewhere in the Atlantic, or in today's Atlantic Ocean. All right, so in that particular time frame during the flood, there would have been a tremendous amount of sediment that was ejected from the ocean floor, and then, of course, would have covered the earth. And in that particular process, there would have been animals being buried in it, plants being buried in it, and it would have begun that process of fossilization. One of the key components to fossilization is that there's a rapid burial. This certainly would have done the trick. Okay, and then, of course, liquefaction. We didn't talk a lot about liquefaction, but it is a really interesting subject. I will leave you to look more of that up. Eventually, that rising flood water would have covered the rupture so that you wouldn't have had quite as much of a fountain. But the water would have continued to come out, and without the major mountains on the earth, as we discussed before, the water would have covered the earth relatively quickly. Talked a little bit about how deep the water would be today if the earth was as smooth as a billiard ball, which is actually fairly rough when you take a billiard ball and blow it up to the size of the earth. The billiard ball is actually much rougher. But you'd have, there's enough water on the earth to flood the earth to a depth of 9,000 feet if it was smooth. Okay? All right. So this is one of my favorite illustrations of the amount of water and air compared to the volume of the earth. That's today. That's pretty cool. if you think about it. And that's not as much water as you might think. Okay? All right. So, talked a little bit about Lake Superior, how it would have covered an area pretty large from about Boston to a little bit past Washington, D.C., would have covered New York. That's just Lake Superior today. And then this is about where we left off. One of the things with the flood is that as the thinner portions of the crust and the higher portions of the crust, as they were supported by that subterranean water, as the water escapes, of course, the continents and those pre-flood mountains, those relatively small, low-level mountains, would have begun to sink. And this is important because if you think back to some of the previous slides that we'd covered with the Mohora Visic layer, that layer of water, as that water is being released, naturally the crust is going to sink. And as the crust sinks, of course, the continents sink. And so the flooding would have resulted as much from the water coming out from the rupture and then coming down as rain as much as it would have resulted from the continents sinking back into the water. This is an important component as we move forward and we get into the third phase of the hydroplate theory. It actually helps to explain a little bit of why we have mountains that generally run parallel to ocean coastlines. And we'll cover that here in just a minute. So just another quick illustration here that begins an important discussion regarding how the supercritical water in the subterranean chambers, as it was released, the water as it covered the earth would have buried a tremendous amount of vegetation. And so it would have trapped it, and it would have begun the process of creating coal and oil. The hydroplate theory is involves a very particular and very important component of that supercritical water. I know we've covered a little bit of this before, but just want to make sure we kind of get a running start into the third phase here. So, in the continental drift phase, right at the end of the initial flood phase, this is approximately where the continents would have been after the initial flood phase. So after the initial rupture had already started, it encircled the globe, much of the water had been released, or the pressure had been released by this particular point. The ridges, or the distances between the coastlines, approximately 800 miles. And at this point, we enter into what is called the continental drift phase. The continental drift phase created a lot of the unique geologic features that we see today, and geographic. So, material that is within the earth, it is compressed by overlying rocks. Kind of makes sense, right? And there is, believe it or not, a slight elasticity to rock. We discussed that a little bit. And the deeper the rock is, the more weight there is above it. Again, makes sense. So the more tightly compressed the spring, if you will, in the rock would be compressed. And this would happen all the way down to the center of the earth. So the rupture path, as it widened during the flood phase, it eventually got to a point where the spring-like rock underneath would have reached a point where there was enough material moved away from it where it began to spring up. So I know it's difficult to imagine, but if you were to follow the topography of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, it rises in the center. That's why it's called a ridge. So there's an elevation change, especially from the continental shelf all the way up to the middle of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. So give you a quick illustration of what that might look like. You have the Mid-Atlantic Ridge there in the center, and as the continents begin to drift away from that uprising plateau in the middle of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, well, several things are going to happen. So this, as the plates began to slide away from each other, the granite hydroplates, well, they start to slide downhill. And this would have removed even more weight from the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. And again, it would have been under some pretty tremendous pressure still from the weight above it. And as that weight was removed, the floor of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge would have begun to rise. And the more weight that's removed, the more quickly it's going to rise. and therefore the hydroplates would have accelerated. They would have removed even more weight from the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, and so it would have continued to rise. And so the entire Atlantic floor rapidly rose almost 10 miles to fill the gap left by the sliding continental plates. So here's a couple of quick examples here. In this first one, you have an example of the overlying rocks that are keeping a compressed spring horizontal. Okay? And if any of you have ever changed struts on a car, you know the fun of when you get that thing tightened down, you got to take it off, you take the spring off. I don't know about if you've ever done that, there's a tremendous amount of angst because that spring is under some tremendous pressure. Okay? So these springs, in this particular case, would have been under a tremendous amount of pressure, and the spring would remain aligned and compressed as the gap between the rocks widened. So as the rocks continue to slide away from each other, that spring is going to stay compressed and horizontal. Eventually, though, the gap is going to reach a certain critical width, and then that spring is suddenly going to buckle upward. This is what happened with the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. So you have your granite crust. Oh, and I'm not going to restart my computer right now. Thank you very much. You have the granite crust, the subterranean water, and of course the basalt layer underneath the water. And then as the crust continued to slide away from each other, the plates continue to slide away from each other, there's the ground underneath stays horizontal until it reaches a critical point where the Mid-Atlantic Ridge began to rise. I'm not sure how well you can read it on the slide there, but you can see, and if you look at a map of the ocean floor or you've seen any illustrations of it, there are all these axial rifts in the Mid-Atlantic Ridge that shows that there was a stressor that caused the earth to rise up and to split horizontally along the same parallel lines. So this is an example of what that might have looked like. So as the Mid-Atlantic Ridge began to rise, the adjacent portions of the chamber floor, they destabilized, and they would have sprung upward. Now, these sliding hydroplates, they would have been lubricated by the still escaping water. So we have dogs in our house, and they drink water. We have a wooden floor in our kitchen. If we don't put the water bottle or the water bowl on a rug, when they walk away, there's a stream of water. You ever stepped on a bit of water on a hard surface? What happens? You slip and hurt your back, right? Well, same kind of thing here. But in this particular case, of course, you would have had continents sliding away from each other as that water was lubricating the surface. So you can think of it this way, as you see on the screen there. Think of a long train rolling down a hill until it eventually hits something. The longer the train, the heavier the train, the more of a mess it's going to make. So you have the same thing happening here with the continental plates. They would have accelerated away from the rising Mid-Atlantic Ridge, and at this particular point, the Atlantic Ridge would have risen almost 10 miles. So in this particular illustration here, you have the overlying rocks that keep that compressed spring, as I mentioned, horizontal until it reaches a critical point where there's enough weight removed. The fracture zones that would have been created from that, they would have run perpendicular to the ridge and also parallel to the ridge as well, and they would have formed many access ridges is what they're called. So as the segment of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge began to rise, it helped lift adjacent portions of the chamber floor enough for them to become unstable and also spring forward. So the further it separated away from one another, the more of the ocean floor would have continued to rise as well. So this process would have continued all along the rupture path. Remember that map that I showed you of the ocean trenches? It would have continued all along that rupture path, forming the Mid-Oceanic Ridge and the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. It also would have formed multiple fracture zones, and then as a result of this, there would have been magnetic anomalies formed. Now, it seems kind of... I enjoy this kind of stuff, but magnetic anomalies are really difficult to explain from an old Earth perspective. And you can see them all over the ocean floor. I'll just leave it at that. For a day or so, the sliding hydroplates were almost perfectly lubricated by the water that was still escaping beneath them. And eventually, as these continental plates were continued to accelerate away from each other, and the Mid-Atlantic Ridge continued to rise, it would have eventually run into some resistance. Okay? So, we covered this a little while ago, but the flood rupture probably would have begun somewhere in the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, and it would have started there, and as that the coastal lines are being formed, and as all that earth is being removed, as the rupture is being formed, you would have had a separation of those plates at that first portion, and then there's a gap that's in there. There's a gap between the two plates, creating space as that rupture continues all the way around the earth. So you have all these plates on a globe that are lubricated by the water, and there's space between them. Okay? But as the Mid-Atlantic Ridge began to rise, they would have eventually run into some sort of resistance. Now, the first is as the lubricating layer of water was depleted. And then, of course, the second is the one that caused some pretty interesting geographic and geologic features. That is, of course, when a plate would have collided with something, generally another plate. As this happened, these decelerating plates would have buckled, they would have crushed, and they would have thickened. And they would have formed much of what we see today in our mountain ranges. Okay, so here's a quick animation of the continental drift phase. It shows one side of the earth at the end of the flood phase. So because the rupture encircled the earth, a similar eroded gap existed between the continental plates on the other side of the globe. The mid-oceanic ridge rose first in the Atlantic, hours or days, before the ridge traveled to and rose in what is now the Pacific. This caused the hydroplates to accelerate downhill on a layer of lubricating water away from one another and away from the widening Atlantic and into the gap on the other side of the earth. Okay, so the continental drift phase would have ended with the dramatic compression event that squeezed up the earth's major mountains. So you look at kind of common geology today, or secular geology, I guess we can call it, the assumption is that the mountains are formed very slowly over trillions or billions of years, depending upon which particular number they want to use, that they're pushed up very slowly. However, the geologic makeup of the mountains don't make that case. They actually work against that particular case. So there's six frames in this particular illustration. It illustrates that as they would have moved away from each other, they would have eventually had to have run into something. And it would have happened somewhere around the sliding away would have been around about today's polar axes. So because of that, there's greater movement at the lower latitudes. Okay? Movement begins from where the continents best fit against the base of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, and it ends near their present locations. So let's just back up for a second. You're looking at this. This is approximately where the plates fit against the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. Eventually, they would have basically ended up approximately where they are today. So they would have slid away from each other. Now, not shown in this are the consequences of this compression event. For example, the compression would have squeezed and thickened the continents. It would have shortened the widths of major continents and widening the Atlantic. Of course, the post-flood mountains, they would have thickened the most, but non-mountainous regions thickened as well. And keep in mind that these continental plates are still covered with a significant amount of debris, significant depth of debris. That plays into or illustrates very well how hydrology works, how the layers would have gotten formed during the continental drift phase. I have a whole section on that, but for the sake of time, we won't go through it. Okay, so regions that did not thicken during this particular process are now part of the shallow ocean floor. Now, While it might seem strange to think of squeezing, thickening, and shortening granite, because granite's pretty hard, one must understand the gigantic forces that would have been required to make this happen, to decelerate the sliding continental plates. If the compressive forces are great enough, granite deforms, much like a putty. If you remember, we talked about that in the first couple of classes, and it would have done so on a global scale. So, just to give you a quick illustration, those are mountains in the Canadian Rockies. This is not the only place that you see them, but this is an excellent example of what would have happened during the continental drift phase, and especially as those plates were running into resistance and starting to thicken. You don't do that to something that's hard. It has to be softened in some way to be able to make those folded mountains. This would have been a result of the continental drift phase, and of course, its effect of running into something. On a human scale, one would not see smooth, putty-like deformations, though. Instead, one would see and hear blocks of granite fracturing and sliding over one another. Some blocks would be the size of a small state or a province. Many would be the size of a house. And even more would be the size of a grain of sand. So, you know, you think about this from Noah's family's perspective. I wonder how much of it they heard. And I mean, it's pretty amazing to consider, again, to be one of those things that I don't know. You know, maybe the Lord will just zot me and show me how it happened. But it would be amazing to consider what that would look like, sound like, smell like, the whole nine yards. So, friction at all the sliding surfaces would generate a tremendous amount of heat. At great depths, this would melt rock. And so that liquid rock, or magma, would squirt up and fill spaces between the blocks. This is seen in most places where what are called basement rocks are exposed. A great example of that is the Black Canyon of the Gunnison. So just to give you some scale, that little green stuff on the top, those are mature trees. So that's a very, very, very tall cliff. And you can see how the melted rock had gotten pushed up into the cracks that were formed during the continental drift phase. Another example here is in the inner gorge of the Grand Canyon. So these are very large-scale events, and it's difficult to really imagine how that might have happened outside of a worldwide cataclysm. Okay, so to illustrate the compression event, and the amount of forces involved, consider the following situation. So you're in your car and you're going 45 miles an hour. Okay? You gently step on the brake as you approach a stoplight and brace yourself by straightening and stiffening your arms against the steering wheel. Okay? You'll feel about 15 pounds of compressive force in each arm. About what you would feel lifting 15 pounds above your head with each hand. Now, if we repeated this gentle deceleration at the stoplight, but each time doubled your weight, the compressive force in your arms would also double each time. After about six doublings, especially if you were sitting on a lubricated surface, your arm bones would break. If your bones were made of steel, they would break after nine doublings. If your arm bones were 1 foot in diameter and made of granite, which is a much stronger material, 17 doublings would crush them. So this compression would be comparable to that at the top of each of the decelerating hydroplates. The compression at the base of the hydroplate exceeded the crushing strength of granite. Even before the deceleration, This was simply due to the weight of the overlying rock. So you have a very thick layer of crust, and as they're moving, the weight of the crust on top would have crushed the granite underneath, again, melting it and then squirting it up through the cracks that had been formed in the granite above. Okay, so as a consequence of this, crashing hydroplates at the end of the continental drift phase crushed and thickened each hydroplate for many minutes. Mountains were quickly squeezed up. As the mountains and continents rose, the floodwaters receded. So for each cubic mile that rose, 1 cubic mile of water was able to drain. This map that you're seeing here is an illustration of the thickness of the continents and some of the, specifically around the mountains and some of the plateaus. Over on the continent to your right, that's my right hand, a continent over here, some of you might recognize this, that's India, of course, but this area right here is called the Tibetan Plateau. It's one of the largest uplift areas in the world. It's a huge, huge plateau that would have been formed during this continental drift phase. So, as we'd explained earlier, the forces that were acting during this event were not applied to stationary or static continents resting on other rocks. The forces were dynamic. They were moving. They were changing. They were produced by rapidly decelerating hydroplates that were riding on lubricated water that had not yet escaped from beneath them. So there was still some water under there. So naturally, the long axis of each buckled mountain was generally perpendicular to its hydroplates' motion. So, in other words, as the hydroplates were sliding this way, the mountains were formed this way because they would have run into something and pushed up. Okay? So they would have been parallel to the portion of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge from which they had slid. So you look at the Rocky Mountains, the Appalachians, and the Andes, they all have north-south orientations. And of course, you can see the Rocky Mountains there on the western half of the United States, and then of course down into South America. And then of course on the eastern end of the United States, there's the Appalachian Mountains, quote unquote. You guys know what those are? Okay. Anyway. So, again, they all run essentially parallel to the ocean portion from which they would have slid. Mike's got a question. 2 questions.
So, what you're saying is that the plates were running, when they were sliding, they were going 45 miles an hour.
Not necessarily. It was just an illustration that we can relate to. They would have been going actually much faster.
So has he determined that then, or
I do remember that he had a number, but I don't recall what it was.
But it was faster than 45 miles an hour.
Yes.
So a great amount of pressure, and then so at that time too, if I'm following you correctly, there was water beneath the plates, but also on top.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yep.
Hmm. That makes it interesting too.
Yes, it does. All right. So as the plates were sliding away, they eventually would have run into some resistance, and then we would have had what was called buckling. So the upward buckling of a deep rock floor, it actually has been observed. So remember I talked about how the Mid-Atlantic Ridge would have buckled upward? This is not just a theory that's never been observed. It actually has been observed. There's a limestone quarry floor that buckled upward in Yorkshire, England in 1887. So they had been digging out the limestone and the marble. It was on a shale base, and it ruptured upward. The explanation is actually pretty simple. The shale that lays beneath the floor, it consists of plate-like particles. They can slide over each other, kind of like playing cards in a deck. The weight of the quarry's walls squeezed shale toward the center of the quarry, and increasing pressure on the quarry floor would have caused that buckling to begin. Once it began, the limestone floor weakened, and it would have allowed the shale to push up even more. So, lots of simple illustrations you can think about in this, but you know, if you've ever made dough or you've made like raviolis and you take your little ravioli cutter or you know, cut them with a knife. Usually you have to use like a cookie cutter or something. Maybe sugar cookies are a good example. When you push on the dough and you push on the edges, it tends to bubble, to fill up in the center. Not a lot, but same basic illustration. The weight here would have caused that shale to uplift. All right, so here's another kind of a simple illustration here. In the flood cataclysm, though, I guess before we get to that, the quarry was 10 miles deep and hundreds of miles wide and 46,000 miles long. So there would have been a tremendous amount of pressure on that floor for it to buckle up. So the high upward pressure on the exposed portion of the subterranean chamber was no longer balanced by the weight of the crust pressing down on it. You have an illustration here showing that the upward buckling of the crust, the upward buckling of the basalt below the crust would have pushed the plates away from each other, especially as more and more weight was being removed. As it increases to bulge upward, eventually the hydroplates would have been still resting on what was left of the water. They began to slide downhill away from that rising bulge, and this would have removed even more weight from the chamber floor and the accelerating that upward bulging. So today, the upbuckled region that is the globe encircling mid-oceanic ridge is the result of that. Mechanical and civil engineers call this phenomenon the buckling of a plate on an elastic foundation. It's a really clever name. It can be demonstrated by placing long bricks on top of a foam mattress compressed in a rigid box, then slowly removing the bricks from the foam mattress, beginning at the center and moving outward. So this is something that mechanical and civil engineers recognize as something that actually happens. You can imagine that as you remove enough of the bricks, eventually that foam is going to push up. So as this would happen, a void would open up under the unbuckled foam portion of the mattress, and no void would open deep inside the earth because the pressures are too great. So as the crust would begin to buckle like that, more material would fill in underneath. You wouldn't get those large gaps like that. So consequently, high-pressure rock from below would buckle up to fill that space. That would not leave a void further down, because even deeper rock would fill that space. Okay, so you're not creating these voids like you are in this particular example. So this is interesting, because ultimately the mass from the opposite side of the earth must depress to compensate for the rising of the mid-Atlantic ridge and the entire Atlantic floor. So here's a little interesting tidbit. The Pacific and Indian Oceans, they would have formed rather rapidly, but here's something that's really interesting. If you look at the floor of the mid-Atlantic ridge of the ocean in the... let's just back up for a second. If you look at the floor of the Atlantic Ocean, it is primarily that lower level here. Let me switch to the next slide here. So the area between the continents on the Atlantic, on the floor of the Atlantic Ocean, is not continental crust. Because remember, it would have been the mid-Atlantic ridge would have risen, the continents would have slid away from each other. So that's primarily, that ocean floor is a considerably different makeup than the stuff on the Pacific side. If you look at the Pacific Ocean, it is primarily, the floor of the Pacific Ocean is primarily continental crust. In other words, it's the same material of the stuff that we're walking on. So as the Mid-Atlantic Ridge rose, the Earth essentially collapsed or depressed on itself, forming a very large ocean, the floor of which is continental crust. I would normally get into the slide, but I don't have it on this one. Anybody familiar with what's called the Ring of Fire? It's basically a series of volcanoes that surround the entire Pacific coast. Okay? So, you know, you can start down in New Zealand and you go up along Malaysia and along the eastern edge of Asia, over to Japan, all the way up around into to the Arctic Circle, and then you come back down the western edge of the United States. There's all these volcanoes around there. You ever take a ping pong ball and you stick your thumb in it? It makes about the same shape of the Pacific Ocean and the Ring of Fire, because that portion of the earth would have collapsed to fill in the rising Atlantic floor. Okay, so a couple of predictions that we can make based on this. We talked about the importance of predictions in any good theory. A couple of those predictions is, number one, that beneath major mountains are large volumes of pooled salt water. And recent discoveries support this prediction. This prediction was first made in 1980. Salt water appears to be about 10 miles below the Tibetan Plateau, which is bounded on the south by the largest mountain range on Earth. So Dr. Brown's predictions are coming true. And then two, salty water would be found within cracks in granite 5 to 10 miles below the Earth's surface, where surface water should not be able to penetrate. So if there's water trapped below mountains and within the cracks, low or deep in the in mountain ranges, salt water specifically, it's certainly not surface water. And that's a prediction, two predictions that he had made that had come true based upon his theory. All right, there's a lot of information in phase three. You get the basic idea. As the ocean floors rose, the continents slid away from each other, forming today's major mountains. Collapsing the Pacific side, forming the Pacific Ocean, essentially being continental crust. So, the last phase is the recovery phase. So the recovery phase, I always covered these, the recovery phase answers the question, well, where did the water go? Brad, you had asked this question last week. So, when the compression event began on a particular hydroplate, the plate would have crushed, thickened, buckled, and rose out of the water. As it did, the floodwaters, of course, would have receded from that particular continental crust. Simultaneously, the upward surging subterranean water was choked off as the plate settled onto that subterranean chamber floor. With the water source being shut off, the deep, newly opened basins between the continents became the reservoirs into which the flood waters drained. Pretty straightforward. As you might recall, the floors of these deep ocean reservoirs were initially part of the basalt floor of the subterranean chamber, about 10 miles below the Earth's surface. So consequently, sea level soon after the flood was several miles lower than it is today. This would have provided land bridges between continents, facilitating animal and human migration for perhaps several centuries. So most of you have probably heard of all the land bridges that once connected the continents. Well, they make a lot of sense, and especially in terms of human migration and animal migration. So back to this slide that I've said we were going to see several times. The seafloor features of underwater peninsulas are readily visible on the floor of the ocean. So you can see all those areas that jut off of the coastlines around the globe, that these areas would have been probably at least immediately above water immediately after the flood and after at the first portion of the recovery phase. Off the western coast of South America, there's actually an island that many of you have probably heard of that was once connected by that very long mass of land right about there. You know what's right about there? The Galapagos Islands. You ever wonder how the animals got there? I mean, you know, you ask an evolutionist, they apparently learned to fly and then got there and forgot. But no, I'm just kidding. you never know. But they would have gotten there over the land bridge at the beginnings of the recovery phase. All right, so in continuing to answer this question of where did the water go, sediments that would have mixed with organic matter and its bacteria, they were swept away with the draining floodwaters onto the new ocean floors. There, the bacteria would have fed on organic matter, and they would have produced methane. I'd mentioned methane hydrates earlier, and I think it was in the first class. And methane hydrates are an interesting thing. So since then, much of this methane combined with cold, deep ocean water to become vast amounts of methane hydrates along the coastlines. And I think if I remember correctly, I'd shown you a slide illustrating where they think all the methane hydrates are. Well, these methane hydrates would have been trapped in those deep pockets of water, you can see that black spot kind of on the green side of the continental shelf, that's where they would expect to find methane hydrates. This map, I do remember showing you this. There's the yellow dots they illustrate where there has been recovered gas hydrates, and the red is where inferred gas hydrates are. And if you remember, methane hydrates are basically methane molecules trapped in ice crystals. You can pick the ice out of the ocean and light it on fire. The methane burns out, water melts away. So this is a result of the flood. And the fact that they can get a pretty good idea where they all are fits well into the rest of the hydroplate theory. So a couple of other things here. After the flood, hydroplates rested on parts of the former chamber floor, and oceans would have covered the rest. As the floods, after the flood, and as these plates began to rest on the former chamber floors, because the thickened hydroplates applied greater pressure to the floor than the water did, the hydroplates slowly sank into the chamber floor over the centuries, causing a deep ocean floor to rise. As sea level rose in the early centuries after the flood, animals were forced to higher ground and were sometimes isolated on islands far from present continental boundaries. Classic examples of this, as I mentioned, were the finches and other animals that Charles Darwin found on the Galapagos Islands. All right. So, I'm going to skip some of that. So today, some of these islands are only visible remains of submerged larger areas of land that were once peninsulas coming out from the continents. Of course, Darwin believed that the finches were blown there during a giant storm. That's how he believed they got there. Remember I'd said that they flew there and then forgot? It's not that much different from blowing a bunch of finches onto an island. But even if Darwin's unlikely storm had happened, both a male and a female finch at the same time, rugged enough to survive the traumatic trip, they must have ended up on each island, if that was the case. I mean, just from that perspective. Anyway, so the more sediments that the continents carried and the thicker the continents grew during the compression event, the deeper they would have sunk. So this also would have continued to depress the Moho. Newly formed mountains would have sank even more, slowly depressing the Moho beneath them to 20 to 30 miles below the Earth's surface. The Moho and the mantle under the ocean floor rose along the ocean floor, and this is why continental material is so different from oceanic material, and why the Moho is so deep beneath the mountains and yet so shallow beneath the ocean floor. Because, of course, mountains are heavy. The heavier they are, the more they sink. That's why the Moho is deeper underneath the mountains and shallower beneath the ocean floor. So many other things during the recovery phase, and especially in the early portion of the recovery phase, were not in equilibrium either. Okay, during this drift phase, the Earth would have continued, or the continental plates would have continued to settle on the Earth. Sinking mountains, they would have increased the pressure under the crust on both sides of the mountains. So weaker portions of the overlying crust fractured and rose, and they would have formed plateaus. In other words, as continents and mountains sank, plateaus rose. So going back to our waterbed example from a while ago, if you were to take a waterbed and you have it filled up with water, and you put a brick, let's say one of those small red bricks, on the center of the waterbed, and then you take two heavy cinder blocks and you put it on either side, well, what's going to happen to the brick in the center? It's not going to stay at the same level. It's going to push up. The cinder blocks are going to sink lower. So if you imagine the waterbed being the under portion of the crust of the Earth, it would have been sinking. All right. So as these mountain ranges and the continental plates settled, the plateaus would have been picked up, would have been pushed up. So a good example of that, as I mentioned earlier, is the Tibetan Plateau. The Tibetan Plateau is rather interesting. There's a certain mountain in the Tibetan Plateau, mountain range, but there's one that everybody tries to climb. Yeah. Okay. It's kind of high. It's kind of pushed up. And the Tibetan Plateau would have resulted from the compression event and would have resulted from the settling plates and pushing up the Tibetan Plateau itself. This also explains why strange aspects like plateaus, they have horizontal strata and they have thicker moho layers underneath them. So remember, the Mohorovicic layer runs all the way around the Earth. It's a layer that encircles the globe, and it's thicker underneath the plateaus because as the continent sank, it would have pushed it up and there would have been less weight. So it wouldn't have compressed the moho or pushed it down as far. The Tibetan Plateau is the largest plateau in the world. It is next to the most massive mountain range in the world, the Himalayas. The Tibetan Plateau covers 750,000 square miles and rose to an elevation of about 3 miles. The Colorado Plateau, it's next, of course, to the Rocky Mountains, and the Columbia Plateau, next to the Cascade Mountains, are other pretty good examples. And there's your Columbia Plateau. So, although the flood's consequences are correctly sequenced here, this is kind of a sequence of events graph, if you like those kinds of things. I'm a data nerd, so I love this kind of stuff. Although they're not, they are correctly sequenced, each phase has a different time scale. Each consequence that's shown in red here is the subject of subsequent discussions and subsequent chapters in the book. So just to give you, just a step away, and hopefully you can read some of this. If not, I'll kind of read it to you. During the rupture phase in the fountains of the great deep, he actually discusses where comets, asteroids, and meteoroids would have come from. Comets are very interesting. They all have a very particular orbit and some very particular and peculiar components to them that relates specifically to the Earth. During the rupture phase, you would have found frozen mammoths. Remember, I talked about how they found frozen mammoths with food still digesting in their stomachs. Well, at the time, they were killed, and they found food in their stomachs that hadn't been digested. During the flood phase, you would have had the continental shelves and the slopes forming. You would have had most of the fossils in the limestone form during the flood phase. And then, of course, the sediments and the fossils were sorted and layered by liquefaction. Liquefaction is really pretty interesting if you do some research on it. During the continental drift phase, which would not have lasted very long, coal, oil, and salt domes would have formed. They would have begun that process. And then at the compression event between the continental drift phase and the recovery phase, which continues today, and if you ever hear, by the way, if you ever hear of an earthquake on one side of the Ring of Fire on one side of the Pacific Ocean, watch for another one on the other side or within close proximity because the Earth is still trying to settle during the recovery phase. So during the recovery phase, the ocean trenches would have formed, submarine canyons, methane hydrates, plateaus, all those things would have formed. The magnetic variations would have formed. The Grand Canyon and many other canyons would have formed. Each of these would have formed in weeks. The Grand Canyon is an interesting one. I will probably get into that. You would have had the Ice Age, earthquakes, volcanic activity, and then the Earth's access precesses. Okay, so let's stop and think about this for just a second. You take a bowling ball with no holes in it, and you spin it. The whole point of the bowling ball is that it's going to spin in a regular rotation, right? Now you take a significant chunk of weight out of one side of the bowling ball and you spin it. What's it going to do? It's going to wobble until it finds its equilibrium point, and then it'll spin where there's less weight. Well, do the same thing to the globe, and you push more weight from one side to the other in its rotation, it's going to have to eventually reach a point of equilibrium. So that's where we have an axis shift in the Earth, which explains a number of the reasons why we find tropical fossils in areas covered in snow and ice, because that rotation of the earth would have created it. All right, so in this recovery phase, the last thing, I'm not going to talk about it tonight, but that's what we'll pick up with next week, is the earth roll. I mean, I gave you the basic overview of it, but we'll talk a little bit more about that next week. Again, 16 weeks worth of information in 5. So, I know I've covered a lot. Any questions, clarifications I can make? All right. Thank you for your time. Who's doing prayer session?